welcome everyone. Amazing to see everyone here again. And yeah, as always, just a real privilege to have this space to have an amazing meditation session and share some spiritual teachings. So my name is Nabushi, for those of you who don't know me, volunteer facilitator. If you have any questions throughout the evening, come and find me. So I'll just keep this brief. We have a newbies guide. If anyone's new to these, welcome to grab one. They're just in the corner over there. Just some Q&A. Also got a project called Sutta Print. Bhante Sujato is very well known for having translated the suttas into contemporary English. So that's like the early Buddhist teaching scriptures. And there's a project to print them and distribute them to local organisations like educational institutions and temples and things. So if you want to contribute to that, there's some information there. And also just remember to take a flyer and share it with your friends, let people know about these things. Can I just ask how people have heard about these events? Like who's heard about it through word of mouth?
Yeah. Someone looks like her.
Okay. Don't need any details, just general. And how else do you hear about it? Is it through the internet? No? Yes?
Yeah, I saw it through the Meta Center.
You Meta Center as well? Is that how you heard about it?
Googling
CE
meditation.
Okay. You came up with the Lakanta site? Okay. Yeah, just good to know.
I heard about it from you. Right?
What?
I think we talked about it and then we did it.
Okay, yeah, sure. There's this amazing monk I know. I also just want to acknowledge the Indigenous custodians of the lands that we're gathering on, the Cammeraygal people, and just pay my respect to their elders. I think it's NAIDOC week next week or something coming up anyway, so keep an eye out for NAIDOC events. Welcome back, Bhante, from Indonesia.
All right.
Auntie and I were just saying that you were speaking to like over 1,000 people for some talks at the time, so just a small group here. Bhante Sujato has been a Buddhist monastic for 30 years. A very senior teacher in this region, and he's published widely, written many things, and done a lot of talks and retreats and workshops, and you can find his talks on YouTube as well, and suttacentral.net, you can find his translations there. He was the abbot of Santi Monastery for about 10 years, and very fortunate to have such a senior teacher come and address us every week. So let's keep it at that. Have a lovely evening. Fine, if you have any questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so very much, Lucy. Excellent. Oh, by the way, advertise my book?
Yes.
Okay. So we just got an endorsement for my book, which is like this very rare for me. I write a lot of books, but no one really reads them. I don't know. But anyway.
That's amazing.
Okay.
It's such a great story of the apocalypse that's upon us. But in a very, very personable way. I could, all the characters in the book are young people, which I guess there's the message in that. How many young people do we have here? It's a wonderful story of how we pretty much destroy our planet, but where the hope is in each other. It's supposed to be fiction. I can safely say that more than 90% of it is not fiction, which makes it very relatable. It's a very good story. It's extremely well written, and I'm very impressed with Bhante. So strongly recommend.
Do you want to go to the cover to the online?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you so much for that.
Okay, very good. I have to say, for me, it's genuinely nice to get good feedback from the work. Obviously, it's nice if people enjoy it. As a writer, you do your thing and you put it out there and you hope that people will connect with it in some way. So, all right. Shall we do our chanting? Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti pi so bhagavā arahaṃ sammā sambuddho. Vijjācaraṇa sampanno sugato lokavidu. Anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati. Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo. Sandhittiko akaliko. Ehi pasiko opanaiko. Pajatam vedita bovinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho. Nyaya patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Yadidam chatari purisa yugani. Atta purisa pungala. Esa bhagavato savaka sangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhineyo. Anjali karaniyo. Anuttaraṃ puṇyakhetaṃ lokassati. I think most of the folks here that I know I've seen before. Is there anyone here who's never done any meditation before? Is anyone who's new to meditation? Oh, excellent. Anyone else? New to meditation. Okay. Come on, man. I don't mean in the Zen sense. I mean in the real sense. Sorry, Venerable Beyond. That was only a joke, okay? I'm sorry. Okay, I allow you to crack Theravada jokes if you want, okay? okay. But it is a good point, right? Whenever we start meditation, then we are informed by what we've done before, by our practice, by our intention, by our ideas, but we also need to start afresh because experience is fresh. Experience is here. Experience is what is happening right now, and it has never happened before in the past. one of the traps that meditators get into is that they'll do a meditation, it's crap, then afterwards they'll be like, my meditation's crap. They think, oh, I'm a bad meditator. No, that's not how it works. When your meditation is crap, that means that you're making progress because you realize that your mind is full of rubbish. That's the starting point. We have to start there, okay? So once we realize that the mind is full of rubbish, then we begin. Then we proceed, and then we have a good meditation. Now it's even worse. Now we think, oh, I have a good meditation. Oh, we come out of it, we think, that was so lovely. How do I get back there? I don't know how many times I've spoken to people like, oh, how do I get back there? There's no there. It was a when, and that when is gone. The only way to get back there is in a TARDIS, unfortunately, in short supply. So each experience we have is new. It has never happened before. I mean, it's not completely new. It's similar to ones we've had before and similar to ones that other people have had before. That's why we can learn, and that's why we can communicate about meditation, because we're not totally alone. Our experience shares something in common with others. But this particular experience, this specific feeling, we can say, is that a feeling an itch? Is that a feeling an ache? Is that a feeling something? But the feeling itself is as it is, and it doesn't really correspond to any particular word, even the word feeling. So each time we meditate, what experience unfolds within us is our reality, and that is our meditation. So don't worry too much about whether the meditation's good or the meditation's bad. The main thing is that we are aware of how our mind is working. Now, to begin with meditation, always the basic is the four P's or the five P's. I can't remember how many there are. I always do this. I always do different ones, so I get confused about how many there are. So let's just run over them again. I was just doing this in Indonesia at the different places that I went to. Didn't really work very well because they had to translate them, so they didn't have peas in them anymore. So whatever. So the first one is P is a place. So this is literally the first thing that the Buddha would say when he's talking about meditation. Gone to a forest, gone to a root of a tree. That's the best place to meditate if you can. If you can't, anywhere that is reasonably quiet and peaceful, where you can be reasonably still, is good enough for meditation, all right? So we find a place for meditation. Then we find a period of time for meditation, okay? So we set aside some time for meditation. This is very important. Meditation is not something you just do while you're sitting at the bus stop or while you're doing this or while you're doing that, right? So people sometimes say this. They say, oh, I can meditate on the train or something like that. What they're actually saying is that meditation is such a low priority for me that I'm not going to set aside a time during my day to do it. I'm just going to fit it in where it doesn't interfere with the other things that I'm doing that are the things that are really important. So if you want to meditate, you need to set aside a period of time to meditate in. Next, we have our posture, meditation posture. Okay, very good. I'm just having a look at folks online, and I'm looking at who's reclining on any couches. No, we're not doing too badly. Okay, don't look too bad. Venerable Beyond's doing very good. Okay, we can see Venerable Beyond's good. Nice posture. Okay. So when we sit here in this room, most of us are sitting on the chairs. That's fine. If you want to sit on the floor, this is fine. We have carpeted floor. You can sit on the floor to meditate. Actually, always the best if you can. But however you're going to sit, it should be balanced and alert, not too sloppy and comfy, right? And not too tight and too hard, right? You should have a sense of ease in your posture. It should be energetic, balanced, and at ease. So period of time, a place, period, posture, and a purpose. Oh, that's right. I remember the other P. Now I've got five. First one, before any of those, before your place, before your period, before your posture, your precepts. Right. Number one, that's the first P. Your precepts. That means don't like be a bad person. Okay. So Buddha's I'm not looking at anyone in particular. Okay. Okay. Don't take it personally. So Buddha's precept is not to kill, not to steal, right? Not to commit sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to take alcohol and drugs. These are the basic five precepts. Obviously, there's a lot more to it than that, but this is the basic framework that we have for Buddhist ethics. So this is the foundation for our practice. If we're not living our life in a good way, right? If we're not keeping precepts, can we meditate? Yes. Is it a good idea? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I wouldn't say that you can't meditate unless you're keeping precepts, but I do think that what happens when you meditate is that you amplify what is in your mind. And if you are already double thinking your precepts, that is to say, if you're already rationalizing to yourself why you don't need to keep your precepts, right? Which is what we do, right? We do something bad and we rationalize to ourselves why I'm doing that bad thing. If you meditate, you'll learn how to do that better. You'll be able to rationalize your immorality more clearly, in more sophisticated ways, more consistently and more coherently. Heck, you can even write a book about it. It's very profitable, okay? If you want to explain to people why it's okay for them to do bad things, this is actually a major sector of the spirituality book market. So, you know, you can certainly get a good living from that.
I'm really curious to know what books you're referring
to. Oh, well, I mean, an obvious example would be Chogyam Trungpa or Osho, Rajneesh. That's correct, the sex cult kind of vibe, yes.
There was a more sinister one, Aleister Crowley.
Aleister Crowley, yeah. But he was not so much like I'm going to justify. He was more like I'm going to revel in my doing the evil. But anyway, but fair enough, yeah. Anyway, so this is what happens, you know. I mean, we're, you know, kind of joking around a little bit here, but it is a very real thing. This is why sila comes first. If you don't get your conduct in order, then when you do your spiritual development, it will tend to be corrupted and tend to you will use that to justify and amplify those harmful things that you've done before. So precepts, place, period, posture, and purpose, the fifth P. Okay, so that means that when you come to meditate, that you have a clear idea what it is that you're doing when you're meditating. For a start, you know what is the meditation method that you're going to be doing, right? That has to be very clear in your mind. You don't sit down to meditate, and then 10 minutes later, you're like, oh, hang on, what was I doing? I watched the breath. I did that last time, and so on. So please come in. Welcome. Okay, so don't worry, you just missed the boring bits. We just came to the good bits, so come in. So that's right, the kind of meditation that you're going to be doing. You have to have a clear idea in your mind, and you have to establish that, right? The Buddha says, you sating upatthapetva, you establish the mindfulness. So you know, now is my time to do this meditation. Shall we do a survey to see what kind of meditation we want to do? Right? Shall we do that? Okay, so I did this in Indonesia a few times. It was quite good because I explained to them we're going to do this like modern democracy. So this is where I'm going to give you a series of options. You're going to feel like you voted for something. And we're going to end up doing like what I wanted to do in the first place. So that's how that process works.
What do you want to do?
I only want to do what you want to do. Oh. And what you want to do is... No, I'm only kidding. Let me explain what you want to do. Okay, so one suggestion we had, metta meditation. So who... Oh, no, I should tell you the three options first. So one option, metta meditation. That's good. Does anybody else have another suggestion?
Vipassana.
Vipassana. Okay, two.
Elements.
Elements. Okay, so now we've got three options. Is that enough? Okay, so we've now got three options. Vipassana meditation, that's insight meditation. Good choice. Metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. Has there ever been a time in history when the world was more in need of love? I don't know. I don't think so. Okay. Loving kindness meditation and elements meditation. Okay. Four elements. Okay. So who wants to do insight meditation, Vipassana meditation? Okay. One very tentative hand. Not even the person who proposed it put the hand up for that one. You heard the other options and they were better. Okay, fine. Okay, so we pass on us off the table, fine. No, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. And next one, loving kindness meditation. Who wants to do loving kindness meditation? Very popular. Okay, very good. And four elements meditation. Okay, a few, but not so many. It looks like we're doing loving kindness meditation. Excellent. Great choice, everybody. Oh, yes, mobile phones. Please turn them off.
With Meta.
Not necessarily, just. Okay, fine. So let me say a few words about loving kindness meditation and then we'll do some guided meditation together. All right. So we know what hate is. Hate is the wishing of ill. Hate is the desire for others or oneself to be hurt, to experience harm, to experience pain. And love is the opposite. So love is the wish for wellness, the wish for happiness. Love is that which ignores all of those complications around things and comes back to that one central principle. May you be happy. Metta, we call love or loving kindness, is the simplest of emotions. It is not bound up with all of our desires and our attachments, all of our fears and those things. It doesn't know anything about those things. Metta itself doesn't understand those things. To a heart, when a heart is full of love, to see jealousy, to see cruelty is completely incomprehensible. It's completely beyond the pale. Heart of love has so much purity in it that it is shining in its simplicity. And because of that simplicity of love, it leads the mind to a simplicity in itself. One of the key factors of this meditation is that it heals and creates wholeness in the mind. So think about it. Think about how fractured our minds become, how happiness becomes tinged with sadness, how longing becomes complicated with frustration. How all of those things that we take to be good in our life are also associated with struggles and problems. That's how life is. That's the complexities of life. In metta meditation, none of that exists. None of that just falls away. And we realize that all of those things actually are also just constructs of the mind. So metta is unspeakably simple. May you be happy. When we're doing metta meditation, we are not philosophizing about metta, we're not thinking about metta, we're not doing all of those things. What we're doing is we are cultivating that feeling, okay? Feeling. It's a meditation on an emotion, and an emotion that brings together our heart in a way that is balanced and unified, that dissolves all of the boundaries and tensions within our own heart, as well as those for outside. So the aims of metta meditation are exalted. They are almost transcendent. To have that heart of love for all sentient beings. And yet, when we begin the meditation, we begin at home. May I be happy. And I know there might be a lot of people who'd be thinking, yes, love for all beings, that's great. Love for me, come on, man. But the news is, like it or not, you also are one of those sentient beings. And you are just as worthy of love as everybody else. And when everybody else in the world, right, because there are a lot of people doing this meditation. How many people are doing this meditation now? Probably thousands, maybe millions in the world. I don't know. They're doing meditation for all beings, and you are one of them. Right now, there are thousands, maybe millions of people around the world who are personally wishing you well. You can't escape it. There was one time I heard a story of a lady who was at a monastery in England. She left the monastery and afterwards got caught up in a Christian cult. And she wrote a letter back to the monastery saying, oh, now I've become a Christian. Can you please leave me out of metta when you do metta for all beings? And had to write back and say, it's not really how it works. We don't have a list of exceptions. So whether you think you deserve love is meaningless. The fact is that we feel pain and we feel suffering, and that's why we deserve to be happy. Everyone deserves to be happy. Suffering doesn't actually help anyone. So may I be happy. We begin with that. Simple, straightforward. Think if you're not sure how to begin with that, try beginning with imagining yourself as a child. Think of like a photo you had from your childhood, and think of that little boy, that little girl, and think, may they be happy. Yeah. And those of us who are of an advanced age in this audience will know this is one of the secrets of old age, is that we never really grow up, and we're all actually that little boy, that little girl inside. We just act a bit differently, but we're still like that inside. And we still feel as vulnerable, and we still feel as confused, and we still feel as joyous, and we still have all of those feelings still inside us. So we have metta for ourselves, and we accept ourselves no matter what. Having metta for oneself is not about, it's not about making oneself be a perfect person. It's about saying that those things don't matter at this time. May I be happy. Now, as we do that, we find that there is a feeling, some kind of flame or spark, some kind of resonance. And we can't control that. Like, we can sit down, we can do a meditation, we can have a method, we can control all those things. But there comes to a certain point where we either feel it or we don't feel it. And there's nothing that we can do about that. So we just have to be patient. And just wait. Somebody might start this meditation and then immediately be flooded with a feeling of rapture and joy and feel that this love is just overwhelming. Somebody else might practice it for many years and feel nothing. Don't worry, okay? Doesn't matter. What matters is that you're taking a step forward. That's what matters, the direction that you're going in, okay? So for now, we just begin. We'll do metta for ourselves, and because we're just going to do a short meditation today, we'll do metta for ourselves and metta for a loved person, okay? So I want you now to think of one loved person, somebody who's going to be very easy for you to do metta for, okay? All right? So we want for your loved person. The key to the loved person is that it's somebody that you have a simple and uncomplicated love for. Okay, not necessarily the person you love the most, because when you have the person you love the most, then you often have a complicated love-hate relationship with them. Okay, just the nature of things. Yeah, not always, obviously, but often that's the case. And I remember one time I was teaching this in Singapore. There was this young couple in the front row, and I mentioned that bit, and they immediately just looked at each other. And I was like, that is so cute. I thought that was wonderful that they had such self-awareness that they knew immediately that that was what was going on. I thought that was really nice. So so it's not the person you love the most. It's the person that you love the simplest, okay? And just one loved person, okay, for each meditation. Again, the meditation itself, we want to keep as simple as we possibly can. So just one person per meditation, okay? You want to do other loved people, that's fine, next time, okay? So if you've got children, for example, okay, you get in there and you think, oh, may Bobby be happy, but then what about Jenny? Oh, no, no, what about Bill? Oh, which one do I love the most? Don't worry about it, okay? Just do one time and another time, okay? It's not a judgment on you as a parent or something like that. It's just a way of developing meditation, okay? All right, what else? Oh, don't do metta for, generally speaking, don't do metta for dead people because all of these instructions are only for in the meditation itself, okay? So we treat the meditation like a laboratory. So it has to be kept as simple and clean as possible, right? Why don't we do metta for dead people? Because when we're meditating, we don't want them to come back and visit us. That could be unpleasant for everybody and disturb our meditation. But more importantly, also when you have somebody who you love who's passed away, then the feelings of grief will come, okay, and loss, and that will affect the meditation. So again, purpose of the meditation, think of it like a laboratory environment. We develop metta very simply and very purely, okay? Outside of the meditation, of course, we do metta for everyone. Don't worry about any of these things I'm saying. This is only for the meditation itself. All right, let us begin. So sitting quietly, we allow our mind to settle inside our body. And notice what feeling that you're bringing into the meditation, whether it's excitement, nervousness, hope, joy, whatever it is. Just notice it, accept it, let it go. Now, leaving the mind, settle in the heart. Say to yourself the words, may I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. And repeating those words again and again, evenly, steadily, clearly, making a firm foundation for your mind. Focus inside your body. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Don't worry about any doubts you may have. Don't worry if your mind drifts off. Don't worry about anything at all. Just that one thing. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Now, as you continue saying those words to yourself, see if you can feel that gentle movement of pleasure. Maybe it's like a soft glow of moonlight through the leaves. Or maybe it's like water seeping through a cloth. But when you feel it, you feel that softness. You feel that pleasure. You feel that ease that it brings, dissolving any anxiety and any tension. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Now moving to metta for the loved one. And keep your mind exactly as it is. Don't change anything. Just use the name of that loved one in your words of metta. So if I do metta for my father, then may my father be happy. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. Or whoever it is that you've chosen, may they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keeping the mind focused inside your body. Keeping the attention with that feeling of metta. Soaking and seeping through your whole body. May they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. And now coming near to the end of the meditation. From the loved one back to oneself, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. And letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, and allowing the mind to return to a neutral space, empty, open and clear. And with the mind empty and clear, take a minute to reflect back over the meditation, asking yourself what just happened. Why did it happen? How did my mind feel when I started the meditation? What emotions was going on me at that time? How did that change? Did I feel that feeling of metta? What was it like? What does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can share the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. And I want to do a special dedication today of sharing the merit from all our practice with our friends at the Buddhist Library. Some of you are probably on their mailing list and know they just got a new place in Glebe after a long search. So sadhu, 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 mudita, celebrating with the Buddhist Library. And hope they're very successful in the new place. And they are looking for volunteers to help them move. So anybody wants to help out moving, I guess they've got some books to move and other things. So check out their website. Okay, let's have a bit of a break, grab a cup of tea, and then come back with some Dhamma talk. They're moving to, sorry? When? I'm not sure. The message I saw didn't say when, but it's, I think, fairly soon. Check the Buddhist Library website. The Buddhist Library website?
Yeah.
Yeah, just the Buddhist Library, yeah. I have some water. Some more water would be good. No, but I do want something. Obviously not enough bell ringing. All right, so since we began this evening talking about metta meditation, I thought I might continue on the same theme for the talk and just say a few words, giving some background and context for this particular practice. So we just did some metta meditation just now. How was it?
It's all right? I feel metted up.
You feel metted up. At the back, sorry? We have a thumbs up at the back. Excellent. Very. Sinsin missed it. Sinsin. Okay, Sinsin, you are full of metta anyway, so. Right?
I actually got here and then I tried to open the door, not the other
room. Okay. Ah, okay. Okay. So. All right, so people like the metta, that's good. How many people should I? Is this a personal question? Don't answer if this feels like a personal question. But I'll be just for my own sake as a meditation teacher. I'm interested to know, like, how many people feel that they like felt that feeling of metta. They felt the feeling of joy in the meditation. Had a few people. A few people. Okay, it's good. Good. Excellent.
I felt grief.
You felt grief. Tell us about it.
My grandma, and I really miss her. So guilt is not being with her.
Right, and your grandma was your love person.
Yes, she just got away.
But she's still alive.
Yeah.
So you did metta for your grandma, who's still alive, but even then you still felt that feeling of grief and loss. Yeah.
And
I
was filled with the memories.
Yeah.
And I was with her versus.
Right. It's complicated, yeah. So that's a very good point. So like I said from the beginning, the metta is very simple. Okay. Now, if that happens, right, and you feel that grief and loss when you think of your grandma and you do it, my general advice with everything, okay, is I wouldn't worry about it too much. Okay. That's fine. But if you do that a few times and it persistently comes like that, then maybe try someone else for metta, okay? Once or twice, never mind, right? But so this is why we learn, right? We learn, oh, actually, so that doesn't mean there's anything wrong. Actually, it's kind of beautiful, right, to think of your grandma and then have those feelings coming up and everything, and it brings those emotions alive, you know? So to me, like as a meditation teacher, right, when you say something like that, it doesn't mean that there was some problem with the development of metta. What it means is that there was something genuine in the way you were connecting with your feelings, right? That is what really matters. That's the number one thing in developing metta, so that it's not just stuck in words, not just stuck in an idea of what we should be doing, but it's actually making that genuine connection. So to me, that's a really good sign. Did anybody else have any experiences they wanted to share? Yeah.
It's interesting. Meditation in general is quite pleasant.
I'll just repeat it for the online, yeah.
Specifically, it's like so pleasurable.
Okay.
And then also, even though it's such a pleasant sensation, I notice how a distraction is still, you know, ever present.
Okay.
Even from this very pleasurable.
Right. So the metta, so the meditation generally is pleasant, and metta especially, but still there are distractions which are still persisting. Okay. So why is that?
The mind.
Okay. What?
It's nature.
It's nature, specifically. Okay.
In those moments, so I think just naturally, it's very easy for me to be distracted.
It's easy for you to be distracted. Okay. Okay. So, but that points to something which is really important in the development of meditation. So let me just dwell on that a little bit. Okay. We meditate because whatever. We have all different reasons, but ultimately we want peace. We want something. We're looking for peace. We're looking for freedom from suffering. Right. Somehow, however we conceive it, doesn't matter too much. But we feel ourselves separated from that thing. Like we can feel a movement towards it, but we still feel separated from it. And when we develop metta meditation, or we develop any kind of meditation, the pleasure we feel in meditation is it arises in us as a consequence of letting go. We let go of something that we've been causing suffering for ourselves. Yeah. Now, when that letting go happens, it's intuitive, and we don't necessarily exactly know what we've let go of or why we've let go of it, right? It just happens. This is why we do the process of reflection at the end of the meditation. We look back and we think, ah, that was that pleasant feeling that happened in meditation. Ah, what happened there? What did I let go of? And over time, we can reflect and we can learn. We think, ah, that's right. That's what I let go of. Yeah, Ah, that's what it was. So this is a process, an active process of reflection and learning. It doesn't, it's not just obvious why these things happen. And so this is the difference between developing a meditation practice and somebody who just has a nice feeling, right? So anybody can go about their day and they can have a nice feeling of metta, right? Happens all the time, right? That's great, but that just comes and goes and we don't really have any say in that. So that's why we develop the meditation, so we understand why it is, how it is. But we're still in that situation where we want to be free and we see the results of that, we see that pleasure, and yet the mind's still coming up with all of these reasons why not. Okay, now this is what we call, delusion. Yes, moha, yeah? Moha is delusion, and delusion wants us to be trapped in suffering, okay? So in Buddhism, all right, let me just say a few things about Buddhism. Okay, so Buddhism is very strange, all right? And I feel like we're constantly in this realm where like other religions don't really understand that we don't really care about the whole God thing, that that's not really part of our thing. And so we're like weird on that respect. But then like secularists and materialists also think we're weird because then we're not religious enough for the other religions, and then we're too religious for the secularists. So we're in this kind of middle space. A lot of Buddhists like to say, who thinks Buddhism is a religion? Who thinks Buddhism is not a religion? It's a way of life. Okay, we're about 50, we're more in the way of life school, about 50-50. I'm in the Buddhism is a weird quasi-religion, but not the way you think it is. So when we approach these, so this is kind of weirdness about the Buddhist path. Like, so we're not directive, and we're not based on some kind of divine authority or anything like this. But we're based on an understanding of experience. And when the Buddha explained how this all came to be, the first term that he used was the term avidya, means ignorance. Okay, everything comes around because of ignorance. Ignorance is not like a first beginning of things. The Buddha rejected the idea that there was a first beginning of things, or at least he said that it's unknowable. But avidya is fundamental in creating all of this stuff that we see. It stands at the beginning of dependent origination. So in a way, the process of practicing Buddhism is a process of learning. It's a process of coming to know things. Now, avidya is unknowing. Avidya does not know what is what. It doesn't know who I am, what the world is, what is my relationship to the world, how suffering originates, all of these things. Avidya does not know those things, right? But moha is what I'm talking about here. Moha is delusion. Moha is slightly different from avidya. I mean, basically, it's the same thing, right? You can say that they're synonyms, right? But they work slightly differently. Moha is not just the unknowing of things. Moha is a force that hides the knowing of things. Ah, moha makes a world of delusion that hides the real truth. Yeah? A good example of moha would be the story of the bodhisattva when he went forth and he came out from the palace and his father had hidden all signs of old age, sickness and death from him. Yeah? And so this is the power of moha, right? And then he went out and he saw through those things. So moha is not just simply the unknowing of that, right? So the fact that he hadn't known it was his avidya, his ignorance. But the fact that it was actively hidden from him, this is the moha. Again, I'm not saying these are completely different things. I'm just like pointing to different ways in which these things work. And that aspect of moha, you can see like is actually it's quite similar to how we live in the world today, right? I mean, we also live in a world where we pretend that people don't get old and don't get die. I mean, you know what? You don't get old, you have surgery. I mean, that's what we do these days. We don't die. You don't see death around because we hide it away. Yeah. was one of the really kind of first shocking things that I found when I went to Thailand, my first encounter with a Buddhist country. I was in Chiang Mai, I went for a walk to the city square, and they had an exhibition. It was like a medical expo or something like that in the city square. And then they had these cadavers just out on display in the city square. And you could just like walk along and see there's these dead bodies there, and everyone just hanging around and like, oh yeah, there's some dead bodies here. And there's just like a medical exhibition, right? okay, it's just natural. It's just a dead body. So we hide those things. We don't want to know. We want to pretend that the world is not like that. So this is that power of moha, okay? And moha constructs this whole alternate reality in which we live. And we can see that this happens like on an industrial scale through like advertising and algorithms and AI, and all of these things are constructing a realm of alternate reality which substitutes for the truth, erases the truth. So that's on an external level. But inside, we do the same thing. We make up a world that we believe in that is not the reality. And that world is characterized by beliefs and opinions. Beliefs and opinions are fine, but never forget that any kind of belief or opinion or view we have is based on our past experience. And that past experience is limited and it's conditioned. So it may be a good view or belief, that's fine, but it's not real. It's just a belief. Right? What's real is what we experience. And so the Buddha always wanted us to come back to the sheer bleeding edge of experience, to know what is happening as it's happening. And what is happening as it's happening, when we experience that, we reduce as much as possible any kind of like conceptual filter or apparatus that we use for hiding reality. And this is something that manifests for any meditator in very straightforward ways. Number one, you sit down to meditate. After a minute, it hurts. Right? It's very simple, right? Dukkha is present in your body, and we are constantly masking that dukkha by changing our postures, by seeking comfort, by adjusting ourselves, all of these kinds of things that we do without really being aware of it, right, to mask the suffering in our body. We sit down to meditate. I'm not going to move. I'm just going to be aware in my body. Ow, my back. Ooh, that's sore. And all of these kinds of pains start revealing themselves to you. Yeah? So, and, of course, this is not a problem. This is the beginnings of awareness. This is the falling of the mask away from dukkha. This is how it begins. So when this is happening in meditation, when we're starting our meditation, okay, so if you're doing metta meditation, okay, let me take a step back. So when we begin to meditate, the things that the Buddha said endarken the mind, that shroud the mind with darkness, are the five hindrances. Okay, so now as I am wont to do, I'm going to do a little bit of a test to see who knows the five hindrances. Okay, number one, how many are there?
Five.
That's very good. Excellent. And what's the first one? Sensual pleasures. Number two?
Ill will.
Number three? Sloth and torpor. Number four?
Restlessness and worry.
Restlessness and remorse, yes. And the last one?
Doubt.
Excellent. Very good. So these five hindrances, the Buddha said, are panya dubbali karana. They are the weakeners of wisdom. And they are like a veil that darkens the mind. Okay? So when we sit to meditate, little bit by little bit, we start to abandon these five hindrances. Now, even though you might feel, oh, no, actually, I've got plenty of hindrances present, but the fact that you are aware of them already means that they are failing, because these hindrances grow in the darkness and they create more darkness. The more ignorance there is, then the more they will grow. When you're aware of them, to be honest, they're already coming to an end. By the time you're aware of them, their game is up. Yeah, they'll struggle and they'll fight, but actually they're on the way out. So we start to meditate. And now when we feel pleasure in meditation, okay, this is a real milestone in meditation. The feeling of pleasure in meditation arises from letting go. It comes because there is something in you that has always been obstructing your truth, obstructing your clarity, obstructing your integrity. There's been some tension inside of you, some way in which your mind has been blocking itself from itself, locking out different parts of your mind and creating a tension in you. That's how your mind works. All of these things are like they build, they're like they become like crusty and stuck. And we feel this tension because of it. And in meditation, without us even knowing, those things start to relax and they open up. And those tensions resolve themselves. You can feel it in your body. Your body becomes more relaxed and has less tension through it. And you can feel it in your mind, and that pleasure starts to flood through your mind. Whether you're doing breath meditation or metta meditation, but metta meditation is especially good for this. It gives a very direct pathway to feeling pleasure in your body. And when that pleasure in your body starts to flood and starts to come through your mind and your body, this is a sign that you have started to let go. That's how it manifests, right? The pleasure you experience in your body is not like a separate thing. It's just the flip side of it. When you have that which is suppressing that happiness, you let go of it, it flips over and you see the other side of it. That's how meditation works. So when you feel that pleasure in your body, it's a sign that the hindrances have started to fade away. This is very good. But right, I say this is very good, okay? The Buddha would say this is very good. That's the voice of wisdom. Moha doesn't think it's very good. Moha thinks, crikey. So just to translate for those overseas. Crikey means, what does crikey mean? Oh, no.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
What the heck is going on?
What the heck is going on? Okay. Crikey. So crikey. Okay. I'm losing control. Moha begins to feel that it's losing control. Right, and starts to lash out, starts to react. Yeah, this is that process, and you will see that process happening again and again and again in meditation. Your mind will get to a certain place where you feel peaceful, and then in some way, some new delusion will come in, and it can manifest in all kinds of ways. It might be, oh, that's nice, good enough, I can stop my meditation now. Right? It might be, oh, now I've got this meditation. Oh, now I'm a good meditator. This is a conceit coming in. Or it might be, now I'm nice and peaceful. Oh, I can fall asleep. That would be good. Yeah. And all kinds of different ways, right? Or now I've done my meditation, I can reward myself with a pizza. Yeah. So many different ways that this can manifest, right? That's how these defilements sneak back in. Right? So it's a constant. Like, I wouldn't say like a battle, but it's a constant cycle where the hindrances are going down and then they will come back again. So you mentioned that you experience that pleasure, and it's kind of weird because the pleasure you experience in meditation is so beautiful, and it's incredible because it's not like dependent on anything. I mean, it's kind of loosely speaking. Of course, it's still dependent on you having life and the opportunity to meditate and so on. But when it happens, it feels so freeing. And so beautiful, and you know that you can experience that pleasure just inside yourself. It's incredible. It's so liberating. You do not need a pill, right? You do not need somebody to give it to you. You do not need some product. You do not need anything. You can just be sitting quietly and still and let go and then experience this incredible peace. It's astonishing. It's revolutionary. So we experience that. And yet our mind is still drawn to suffering, still drawn to distraction. Yeah, this is the power of moha. Yeah? This is natural. This is normal. Okay, it's okay. In Buddhism, we talk about Mara. Who knows what Mara is? Who knows about Mara? Is there anyone who doesn't know who Mara is? You don't know who Mara is? Excellent. Oh, my goodness. People who don't know Mara, that's excellent. Okay, good. I get to talk about Mara now. Okay, so Mara Mara is the trickster. He's the deluder. He's a figure in Buddhist mythology who is always trying to catch you. Okay? Mara is full of wiles and wants to keep you trapped in suffering. But like not in a bad way. Okay? So Mara is not like the devil. Okay? The devil's all like fire and brimstone and horns and sulfur, suffering. Mara's not like that. Mara is like, oh my goodness, look at all that effort you made in meditation. Seems like a lot of work. wouldn't you be more comfortable just like, you know, taking it easy for a little bit? I mean, you can still be a good person, you know, you can still be generous and kind and so on, you know, that's fine. Do you really have to go on retreat? I mean, it seems like that show that you're watching, you're going to miss out on a few episodes. I mean, you're going to have to catch up on that when you get back. And I don't know, it feels like all of these things that you're going to have to miss out on. I don't know if it's really worth it. So Mara is always sort of beguiling like this. Actually, Mara has a kind of interesting history. Mostly is Buddhist, right? You don't find Mara doesn't feature so prominently in other like Hinduism and Jainism, although he does feature, but he seems to be inspired or have something in common with a figure called Namuchi from the Vedas, who is all, Mara's also called Namuchi in the suttas. And some kind of interesting points of correlation there. For example, Mara, you know, manifested to the Buddha in different kinds of ways, trying to distract him, or he manifested, there's a whole chapter where some of the nuns are going and meditating in the dark forest. So this is one of my favorite tropes in Buddhism. So we have this place in Buddhism called the Andhavana, which is near Sarvati, where the Buddha used to stay. Andhavana literally means the dark forest. You will be pleased to know that I did not translate it as Mirkwood, although that was in my first draft of my translations. I mean, but I managed to refrain myself. So
no novels, just in the Tolkien estate.
That's correct, yeah. I could have been in some copyright trouble there. Anyway, so, and it would seem to be a favorite place for the bhikkhunis to go and meditate, so they'd go off and meditate in the dark forest. Wild, doesn't it? I'm just going to go off to the dark forest and do some meditation. And Mara would sometimes come up and try to scare them and so on, and they would usually just glare at him contemptuously and say, Mara, I know you. So one of the things about Mara is that you can just say to him, I know you. You're Mara, the evil one. Come to trick me. And then that's enough. Once you know Mara, then he will disappear. So, for example, one time he came to the bhikkhuni Soma, I think it's Soma, correct me if I'm wrong, Soma, and said to her, what are you doing? Don't you know that a woman can't even attain these things? You're just a feeble-minded woman with her two-fingered wisdom. Okay? Two-fingered wisdom uses this idiom. There's a kind of a number of different theories about exactly what he means by saying the two-fingered wisdom. But I think the commentary says it was a method of testing the cooking of rice. So it meant you had like domestic science wisdom, but not any more wisdom than that. So that was one. I tend to think that it means that two-fingered wisdom, that you don't really grasp things. You just sort of, like that. Maybe it's another reading. Anyway, whatever. And so Soma's response was, who are you, Mara, to talk to me like that? You know, I'm sitting here, my mind is in samadhi, I see vipassana, I see like all the truth of reality as it really is, and I don't even think I am a woman or I am a man or I'm anything at all. Anybody who thinks like that, you can go and talk to them, Mara. So that's what Soma's response was. So if you want to, if anybody tells you that in the Buddhist scriptures that it expresses that women are inferior to men, you say, yes, it's true. It does say that in women's in Buddhist scriptures, but it's Mara who says that. Not the Buddha, it's Mara who says that. So this is the role of Mara, is to twist reality. So Mara is an embodiment of delusion in that way. Huh? But literally Mara means the murderer. Yeah? So Mara is that power of death. So Mara, of course, became, or not of course, but Mara became converted to Buddhism later on. Shall I tell you that story? Do you know the story of how Mara was converted to Buddhism? Do you guys know that story? So this was later, and this is not actually a story that's found in the Pali tradition. It's found in the Sarvastivada tradition. So there was a great teacher called Upagupta. And if you have ever been to Myanmar or northern Thailand, you go to the monasteries, you find on the shrines there, they'll have the image of Upagupta. Some of you may know him also from, if you've been to the Burmese temple in Penang, they have a really nice Upagupta shrine there. You've been there?
Yeah.
It's a stunning temple.
It is.
Yeah, all the wooden carvings and everything. You go around to the side of there and there's an Upagupta shrine. And Upagupta is always sitting there like this. He has his bowl and he's eating from his bowl. His hand's halfway to his mouth and he's looking over at his shoulder like that. Yeah. So why? Because according to the story, he's eating his meal and it's nearly 12 o'clock and he's not finished. So he's using his psychic powers to stop the sun. So he can keep eating and finish his meal. So that's why he's always depicted like that. It's very relatable. The metaphorical meaning, or at least a metaphorical meaning, is Upagupta was the one who kept alive the sasana, sustained the noonday of Buddhism. And kept it alive. So this is what the metaphor, so we could keep on eating the Dhamma, right? So that's what that thing was. Anyway, there's only one mention of Upagupta in Pali scriptures, and that's in a Burmese grammar where it has one phrase as an example of a passive construction, Maro Badho Upagutena. And that's it. There's no context or any other way of understanding it. Maro Badho Upagutena. And Mara was bound by Upagupta. Okay, so what exactly that means. So it's an interesting juncture in history because that is found in a Pali text, but the story is only found in Sanskrit texts translated into Tibetan and Chinese, right? And in those texts, it tells you the story. So what happened was this. Mara came to hassle Upagupta because he was doing such a great job of sustaining Buddhism. And as a result, Upagupta bound Mara with his psychic powers and tied like corpses of snakes around his neck. So he was and like hung dead dogs off him and things like this. So he's constantly surrounded by these putrid, revolting things. And Mara was like, "What are you doing, Upagupta? That's not what you're supposed to do. Like, come on, man! Like." I'm Mara. I'm just doing my job. I'm supposed to be deluding you. That's what I do, you know. You know, you put all these things on me and stuff. Come on, this is so unnecessary. You know who never did that? You know who never did that? The Buddha never did that. I did all of this stuff to the Buddha, and he never hurt me at all. He was so kind. And then the more he went on down like this, he began to realize, oh, my goodness, what did I do? The Buddha was so kind to me and so forgiving. And so that's how Mara became converted to Buddhism. And And after his bank became converted to Buddhism, then he promised a gift to Upagupta. He said, "Oh, thank you, Upagupta." So when he became converted, Upagupta reversed his thing, removed all those bindings, and then Mara said to him, "Ask me, is there anything I can do for you? I'll give you anything you want." And Upagupta said, "You sure?" He said, "Yes, I'll get anything I want." And Upagupta said, "Well, my life has been so blessed because I have had the chance to encounter the Dhamma and to practice the Dhamma. But one thing that I always regret is I was born too late to see the Buddha while he was alive." And he said to Mara, "You were alive in the time of the Buddha, weren't you?" He said, "Yes." He said, "You saw him?" "Yes, many times." He said, "And you're also a master of illusions, right?" He said, "Yes. Not sure if I'm comfortable where this is going." "So you remember what the Buddha's form was like?" He said, "Yes." He said, "So you could take on the Buddha's form?" He said, "Well, theoretically I could, but it would be blasphemy. I'm a Buddhist now. It would be blasphemy to pretend who I'm the Buddha." And Upagupta said, "But you promised. You said you would do anything." Mara says, "Okay." He said, "But one condition." He said, "Why?" He said, "I'll take on the form of the Buddha, but you can't bow to me because I'm still Mara." And Upagupta said, "Okay, fine." So he took on the form of the Buddha, and then Upagupta bows to him. Couldn't help himself. He was so inspired with faith to see the form of the Buddha like that he bowed to him like that. So that's the story of Mara and Upagupta, and how Mara was bound by Upagupta, and how Mara became a Buddhist. Okay, fine. Where were? What was he before? He was mostly into like power and delusion and sex and death and stuff. I don't know if he followed a particularly religion, but he was mostly into trapping people.
He was like a minor god, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did he like reading people's minds?
It wasn't that his motivation that he liked to see what people were thinking, and when they became enlightened, he couldn't like watch them anymore?
So I'll just repeat for folks online. The question was his motivation that he liked reading people's minds, and then when they became enlightened, he couldn't read their minds anymore? I'm not sure. There is a passage in the suttas where he was searching for the consciousness of an arahant who had died and couldn't find it. So maybe that's where that comes from. But I think he was more just generally interested in just keeping people trapped in suffering. Yeah, that was his main thing. Usually a few simple tricks is sufficient. It's not all that difficult. So anyway, I come back to that question about pleasure and distraction, right? So distractions happen. We feel that pleasure and that distraction happens, right? So we personify that as Mara, and we can call it Mara if we like. But, and just for the record, you know, if we want, you know, Mara is talked about in narratives as being a divinity or whatever, but Mara is also talked about in a psychological way from the time of the suttas as well. There's like the 10 armies of Mara, which is like sloth and anger and so on and so forth. So when we experience those things, right, they happen. Again, my advice, boring as it may be, I wouldn't worry about it too much. Don't get obsessed by the distractions. The distractions are not important. What's important is the pleasure. That pleasure is a sign that you've done something right. And it's not, and the fact that there are distractions is not a sign that you need to do something else. That's like the second layer of delusion. Okay? The first layer of delusion is the distraction itself, which is something which comes from inside you, which you think is something outside, but no, it's actually coming from inside you. And then the next layer of delusion is the idea that, oh, I have to do something to fix this problem. Right? So now the I is getting in there. Yeah? So then you can see how that delusion very easily multiplies. So just be simple. This comes back again to that sense of purpose. Remember I said the purpose? So the purpose at the beginning of the meditation is your counteraction, is your counter current. It's something that mitigates delusion because you're clear in your mind what it is that you're doing. If you're doing metta meditation, it is the metta that is your meditation. It's not the distractions and the thoughts and so on. It's the meta. If you're doing breath meditation, it's the breath that's your meditation. That's what brings you to Nibbana. So all of those other things, don't give them too much credit. They're just there. That's just how your mind behaves. Bring it down. Enjoy that pleasure. Keep on enjoying that pleasure. The pleasure is a sign that you are doing something right. Okay? All right. So Venerable Prasanna asking the good questions as always. If Mara was converted by Venerable Upagupta, then he can't bother us these days. And that's why all of us have such great meditation without any problems. Is that right? That seems to follow. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe because that story is only found in the Sarvastivadins, that they, maybe they had great meditation and then we don't have that story in Pali. So I'm not sure. To be honest, I think actually that story is a origin myth for the Buddha image, actually. Yeah. And sort of expresses the discomfort of the early Buddhist community when people started bowing to graven idols, yeah, which today we kind of take for granted. But I think in those days it would have been, well, it was certainly an innovation. It didn't happen in early Buddhism. Anyway, so look, I should probably wrap up about here. We're getting close to 9 o'clock. We need to make sure we leave with enough time for the staff to finish up. Thanks, everybody, for coming along. It's been a pleasure as always. I'll be back here again next week. Please come and join us. I'm also at Crow's Nest on Tuesdays. That's at the 5 Library. Thank you. That's at Parramatta on Tuesdays. That's at the 5 at 6. So please come and join us then. Anything else that needs mentioning at the moment? Any other events on? Anything else? Our sort of discussion this Sunday at what time? Rhonda Place. What time? What time? 1:30. So this Venerable Prasanna is leading it this week, yeah? Yeah? Sinsin's got tickets for my birthday celebration. Oh, my God. I don't even know about it. It's just a secret. It's a secret. Okay. So, not to oversell it. Okay, not to oversell it. But there will be the launching of a new musical. I don't know what you'd say. Sinsin, spectacular, extravaganza, something never heard before. And we're seriously really excited about what's going to be happening. So please talk to Sinsin if you're interested in that. Venerable Prasanna mentions that they're doing DN 31. What's 31? Sigla Vada Sutra, is that right? Okay. And also, so that means that the Pindabhata is on Burwood this week. So if you're around Burwood area, please come and join us around 11 o'clock and we'll have arms round and then we'll have a picnic lunch and it'll be very nice. So please join us for that. Venerable Tenzin's one-day retreat on Chittanupassana on the 4th of July. And where do people go for details of that? Yes. Go to the Metta Center for details of that. Okay, so that's very good. Was there one more thing I was going to mention? When's Dark Week? Dark Week is, I think, the first week, right, of the month. So not next week, I think, but the week after. Yeah, I actually haven't done Dark Week for a while because I've been away. So it'll be coming up this. For those of you who are new, Dark Week is where we invite everybody to wear black and put on your goth makeup or something like that, and we'll discuss something terrifying and traumatic, okay? So please come along for that. But that's, I think, the week after next we'll be doing that. 7th of July, okay. Okay, that's it. See you later, everybody. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.